Good morning. You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind, LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Barry, and I will be reading to you today from the Lowell Sun. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. We hope you're doing well on this December 4th. From the Lowell Sun, Thursday, December 4th, the top story is an education story by Sam Drysdale. Graduation Framework Recommends New Tests. And, of course, tests administered by state seen as potential model after voters nixed high-stakes MCAS exams. High school students would take end-of-course tests designed, administered, and scored by the state under new graduation requirements recommended by state council and cheered by Governor Maura Healey as consistent with the state's high expectations for all students. Passing tests would not be a condition of receiving diploma as it was under the former high-stakes MCAS system, but a major teachers union said the proposal still defies the will of the voters in 2024. Voters in 2024 approved a ballot law to eliminate the MCAS graduation requirement. The K-12 statewide graduation council that Governor Maura Healey formed through an executive order in January was charged with advising the governor and legislature on the development of a statewide graduation requirement. I said a year ago that we were going to work together to create a new model for students in Massachusetts, a new vision that sets every high school student up for success. And today we're speaking to that because here in our state, we don't turn away from students and we don't back down from high expectations, Healey said at a press conference at Dedham High School on Monday. Initial recommendation documents released by the council on Monday include a demonstration of mastery that has two components: exams administered by the state, taken at the end of courses, and capstones or portfolios that are designed, administered, and scored locally. In addition to proving mastery, other recommendations, including requiring the students complete a rigorous program of study that aligns with the admissions requirements for higher education, developing and maintaining an individual career and academic plan, completing federal or state financial aid forms, developing financial literacy forms, skills, and having the option to earn state-designed seals of distinction. The state is searching for new standards after voters detached the MCAS exams from diploma eligibility. Critics said the high stakes exams caused teachers to teach to the test, while supporters said tests are the best way to ensure educational consistency and equity across the state. Healey was joined in Dedham by Lieutenant Governor Driscoll, Education Secretary Patrick Tutwiler, Education Commissioner Pedro Martinez, and American Federation of Teachers of Massachusetts President Jessica Tang. The Massachusetts Teachers Association, which led the ballot question effort against the MCAS graduation requirement, does not endorse the recommendations. The end of course assessments would be administered at the end of specific high school courses like Algebra 1, English Language Arts, Science, and Social Studies. The recommendation for end of course assessments functions alongside the recommended course of study, the recommendation document says. Research on EOC assessments specifically has found that EOC assessments are generally positively correlated with high school graduation rates. With the impacts of math and English language arts, EOC assessments being statistically significant, the document says. Additionally, administering a greater number of EOC assessments generally correlates with higher graduation rates. A press release from the governor's office says that end-of-course assessments are different from high-stakes testing because students do not have to pass an EOC to graduate. EOCs will be a more targeted and relevant approach to assessment than our current high school MCAS. The 100-page document, the 100-page recommendation document is due to be followed by the council's final report in June 2026. The recommendations require legislative action after they are filed, according to the Executive Office of Education. July is the last month for scheduled formal legislative sessions in 2026. The administration is assessing the best way to approach implementation, said EOE spokesperson Alana Davidson. Over the next 6 months, the council will discuss which courses should have an assessment, the weight and role of the test as a component of the system that determines readiness to graduate, and accommodations and alternative formats for students with disabilities, English learners, and newly arrived immigrant students. The council report also outlines the purpose behind redesigning the graduation framework. Co-chairs Education Secretary Patrick Tutwiler and K-12 Commissioner Pedro Martinez wrote that the post-MCAS transition offers Massachusetts an opportunity to update what it means to graduate from a public high school, prepared for today's workforce and post-secondary education opportunities. What we're releasing today, Tutwiler said, is an initial framework, a starting point. It outlines the importance of coursework, offers more opportunities for students to demonstrate their learning in ways that reflects their strengths, and supports them in planning the next chapter of their lives. The report frames the effort as a response to concerns about inconsistent expectations across districts and says a uniform statewide requirement is intended to support rigorous, uniform, and equitable standards for all students. It further situates Massachusetts' work within national trends. A review of other states' graduation requirements found growing use of flexible pathways, master-based demonstrations, and combinations of coursework and performance tasks. The council wrote that a statewide requirement supports mobility, consistency, accountability, transparency for students and families, and argues that a Massachusetts diploma should signal that graduates are well-prepared for college, career, and civic life. Brooke Thompson, president and CEO of Associated Industries of Massachusetts, said the business group supports the standards. Massachusetts' economic future depends on a strong and measurable education system, ensuring that all students meet clear and standardized expectations in core subjects is critical not only for their own success, but for the long-term competitiveness of our state, Thompson said. AIM urges parents, employees, and employers to engage in this work and supporting this vital set of recommendations to ensure Massachusetts remains a leader in educating our children and our future workforce. Though the governor's advisory said union officials were joining Monday morning's press conference, the Massachusetts Teachers Association, the largest teachers union in the state, said they are not endorsing the recommendations. By making new state standardized tests a central component of the new graduation requirements, the proposal defies the will of voters who made clear their wishes in the 2024 question referendum, which passed by nearly 60% in favor. MTA President Max Page and Vice President Deb McCarthy said in a statement. Healy shot back at the union. Let me be perfectly clear. The end of course step assessments are not a high stakes test. They're not. So that's an inaccurate characterization by the Massachusetts Teachers Association, Healy told reporters in Dedham. What the end of course assessments are basically the tests you take normally at the end of your course. That gives us the opportunity to assess how much the students learned, whether the right kind of progress has been made. Though the union is represented on the council, they say members do not vote on the recommendations. These are the recommendations of the secretary and commissioner speaking on behalf of the Healy administration. Tang representing the second largest teachers union in the state, stood by the governor's side for the unveiling of the recommendations in Dedham. This is a starting point, Tang said. Our hope is that the final recommendations accurately reflect what we know residents want, a better secondary school graduation system that moves away from high-stakes testing as well as over-testing. There is an opportunity here to create a better system that authentically reflects and supports the current educational needs of our students, including a focus on deeper learning, critical thinking, lifelong learning, and preparedness for college, vocation, and career. Okay, another story on the front page. Planning Board okays subdivision plan in Lowell. Christian Hills subdivides 7-acre lot into 17 single-family homes. By Melanie Gilbert. In its last meeting of the year, the Planning Board approved an application by Christian Hill Homes, LLC, to subdivide a large rectangular property in Centralville into 17 single-family lots. The board has been discussing the applications in several meetings since this past summer, seeking clarification from the developer on soil and drainage concerns and landscaping and roadway issues relating to the proposed development. We've come a long way from the original submission, Vice Chair Gerald Frechette said during the public meeting held at City Hall. Erosion and flooding of the site, adjacent homes, and the surrounding streets has been a concern of both the board and neighbors since last March, when contractors with the Pelham, New Hampshire firm, owned by Rocco DiPietro, clear-cut the majority of the vegetation on the almost 7-acre property. The formerly forested land, bounded by Llewellyn, Reservoir, and Christian Streets, has been vacant for decades on what an environmental and land planning scientist for a previous developer called a gradual to moderately steep slope. The wooded area held vegetation like willow bushes, cattail, and ferns, and herbaceous plants. Trees like sugar maple, red and white oak, American elm, Japanese honeysuckle, crabapple trees. The latter perhaps giving rise to the colloquial apple orchard name. The scale of DiPietro's project can be visualized thanks to drone footage sent the Sun by resident William Palermo, which can be viewed online. Direct abutter Robert Gignac was one of the four residents who spoke in opposition to subdivision, citing his concerns with mudslides. If you go down First Street, there was a major mudslide not too long ago, he said. At the board's recommendation in its October meeting, the developer obtained the services of a geotechnical engineer to conduct an analysis of the underlying geology and stability of the proposed earth slopes behind some of the proposed homes. I have reviewed the slope report for the Christian Hill development, prepared by Harry Weatherby, P.E. of Geotechnical Services Incorporated, Lowell engineer Joseph Cady said in a report dated December 1st, the day of the meeting. Mr. Weatherby's assessment indicates that the potential for slope failure is remote due to the inherent characteristics of the Paxton and Canton soil series, which consists of dense, heterogeneous mixtures of sand, gravel, and silt. Water runoff and drainage concerns were further issues for the board with the development. In response, the developer and his team further tweaked the plan to include stormwater management report, erosion control plan, calculated stormwater runoff quantity and quality, soil borings, test pit data, documentation of an estimated seasonal high water table, and related calculations in accordance with the standard engineering practices and the Massachusetts Stormwater Manual. The Lowell Stormwater Team has concluded that the proposed stormwater improvements adequately designed to control post-construction runoff generated by this project. Lowell Engineering manager Evan Walsh told the board in the same day report. We believe that our report, that our concerns raised October 17th have been fully addressed. Previously, the board required the developer to install stormwater infiltration dry wells to capture roof runoff to ensure that the proposed systems perform in the field as intended as part of its subdivision approval. The board required that the test pits and soil analysis be conducted for each lot prior to any stormwater infrastructure installation to verify that subsurface conditions are consistent with the assumptions made in the design. Another condition of subdivision approval was for the developer to install granite curbing along the frontage of each property for the full length of the project. At its peak, Christian Hill is a steep street with a 14% slope. Both residents and the board were concerned about the runoff from the roofs of the home and the impervious surfaces like driveways and walkways into the roadway, exacerbating an already volatile downslope drainage pattern. I think it's critical to require the vertical granite curbing as recommended by the city's engineering department, Franchette said. Given the extreme slope and development of this site, it is a proper thing to do. The area was clear cut. The site warrants this. The developer's landscaping plan also calls for 65 trees to be planted on the site for both water retention and canopy purposes. Currently, the site plan proposes 3 retaining walls, and the board required that retaining wall designs be reviewed by the city's building department before any additional permits are issued for the development. During a visit to the site on Monday, a reporter saw an employee with a paving company line marking 4 driveways on the 3 homes already under construction. A real estate sign was planted on the curb of Lot 16 on Christian Street with the Shannon DiPietro of the DiPietro Group Real Estate as a listing agent. The QR code linked to a website that described Christian Hills Estates as an exclusive new community in Lowell's sought-after Christian Hills neighborhood. This thoughtfully planned development plans modern living with neighborhood charm, offering homeowners the rare opportunity to design a residence tailored to their lifestyle. Shannon DiPietro did not respond to several requests for comments on a relationship to developer Rocco DiPietro, nor question any of the under construction or proposed properties already for sale. Nestled on a quiet, elevated setting with convenient access to local amenities, Christian Street Estates delivers a perfect balance of privacy, community, and everyday convenience, the site says. And the last story on the front page by Tim Dunn is Healy-Trump administration battle over vaccines and autism. Governor Maura Healey is slamming Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy over statements he made relating to child vaccines and their potential links to autism that are not related to science. Healey hosted a forum Wednesday at the Department of Public Health headquarters in Boston, where she urged members of the public to maintain their trust in childhood vaccines against what she calls misinformation spread by Kennedy, the DHS, and the Kennedy-influenced CDC. The governor also warned about an upcoming vote this week by the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which could result in an overhaul on how the federal government advises on children's vaccines. We know that Senator Kennedy removed and handpicked members of the ACIP committee. We understand that within the next 2 days, they will be looking at childhood and adolescent immunization, as well as hepatitis B vaccines and general issues related to vaccine safety, Healey said. Based on everything that we've seen and heard so far from Senator Kennedy over the past 9 months, we have real concerns and very little confidence that what they put out will be sound and based on science, she added. Healy this year signed legislation allowing DPH to issue its own vaccine recommendations, she says, that are rooted in science and data, and said that the department will do the same if the CDC votes to delay hepatitis B shots to children. No matter what ACIP does in the next couple of days to advance their agenda, we are going to make sure that vaccine, the hepatitis B, remains available here in Massachusetts, Healy said. The governor also slammed Kennedy in press release last week for a post on the CDC website that she says insinuates a link between vaccines and autism, calling it the latest troubling installment. The governor went on to say that Kennedy and the CDC claims were based on conspiracy theories and false information, not rooted in science. But Health and Human Services is pushing back, defending the CDC website update in a statement sent to the Herald. Governor Healy is just simply wrong. This is common sense update that brings CDC's website in line with our commitment to transparency and our goals, HHS Communications Director Andrew Nixon said. As the updated page explains, the claim that vaccines do not cause autism is not supported by our evidence, as studies to date have not definitively ruled out potential associations. Some research suggesting possible biological mechanisms has been ignored or dismissed by public health agencies. And HHS is committed to it's committed to finding a definitive answer that meets our goals, he said. The Herald asked Healy and DPH Commissioner Robert Goldstein if they would respond to Nixon words. Healy deferred to Goldstein. They're wrong in their interpretation of data, Goldstein said. There are multiple studies, study after study after study, that have demonstrated the safety of vaccines. Studies that have looked at the full pediatric immunization schedule that shows no increased risk of autism or other adverse events. Studies that have looked at individual vaccines and have shown no increased risk of autism or other adverse effects, events, and studies, adjuvants, and other ingredients that are in the vaccine, and it showed no increased risk of autism or other adverse events, he added. So I would ask them to go back and share what data they are looking at to make sure they are interpreting it correctly, which is doubtful. Nixon went on to defend Kennedy's efforts to find the causes of autism, again emphasizing the department's focus on transparency. Secretary Kennedy has launched a comprehensive review of autism's causes, including investigations into environmental and biological factors, with an emphasis on transparency, reproducibility, and gold standard science. The CDC site updates are part of that political effort to ensure all public-facing information reflects our policies, he said. The governor also says the state will continue to provide its own individual vaccine recommendations, regardless of how the CDC committee votes. She then placed the blame on Kennedy and the Trump administration that she says has led to an erosion of trust around the country. At the end of the day, if the federal government or an administration or a secretary at the federal level is not going to do their job, governors here and around the country are going to continue to do theirs, Healy said. And one of our responsibilities is to make sure that we're straight with the public, that we're providing information, we're providing the science, and what we're informing Bay Staters about what's happening and what their options are, and correcting some of the really egregious untruths and misstatements that are out there that have unfortunately led to confusion and erosion of trust around the country, she said. The ACIP committee is expected to debate and vote on recommendations on vaccines for children and adolescents by the end of the week. Inside the Sun, on page 3, We have a story about the Lowell Fire Department. Four firefighters honored for saving life during downtown blaze. Four members received governor's citation after saving a woman during February business fire on Canal Street. By Aaron Curtis. Four members of the Lowell Fire Department were honored last week for saving a woman's life during a February blaze that tore through multiple Central Street businesses in the pre-dawn hours. Lieutenant Michael Dexter, Temporary Officer Stephen Da Silva, and firefighters Oscar Jimenez and Corey Nadau were recognized for their heroics on November 25th at the 36th Annual Firefighter of the Year Awards in Worcester. The men received the governor's group citation for meritorious conduct. During the ceremony, MC Doug Meehan of WCVB recounted for attendees the three-alarm blaze that erupted in the early morning hours of February 24th. Crews arrived on Central Street at about 4:30 a.m. to find no issues at the dispatched address, but heavy black smoke pouring from the neighboring commercial property. The smoke was so thick it triggered alarms in an adjacent building. Engine 4 quickly stretched a line to locate the seat of the fire. Given the early hour and the closed commercial occupancy, Da Silva and Nadau had little reason to expect anyone inside. But stakes were immediately raised when they discovered an unconscious woman on the floor amid high heat, zero visibility, and deteriorating conditions, Meehan said. They radioed command to report they were bringing out an injured patient and successfully carried her from the burning building. Outside, the crew of Engine 1 quickly assessed the victim and determined she had no pulse and was not breathing. Dexter and Jimenez immediately began CPR with rescue breathing, continuing several rounds until paramedics arrived and took over care. And through those efforts, Meehan said, from the rapid entry, victim rescue, and life-saving measures, they saved the woman's life. The fire damaged three businesses in the Saab building with a Boost Mobile and Thrift debt sustaining the heaviest losses. A neighboring storefront, the Beatbox Glass, was also affected. Thanks to the firefighters' swift actions, a greater tragedy was averted. Crews rescued a woman from the first floor. Lowell Fire Chief Philip Chiron said the day of the blaze. They did CPR on her before she was sent to the hospital in critical condition. The four members of the Lowell Fire Department were among the 170 honorees from 15 departments statewide recognized for their actions at 17 emergency scenes between June 20, 2024 and June 30, 2025. This year's rewards reflect selfless acts of courage and skill that saved lives, protected homes, and delivered our most vulnerable residents from danger, Governor Maura Healey said in a press release about the event. To every firefighter who puts on the gear and answers the call, you have my gratitude and the gratitude of our entire state. We are so proud to support you as you support our safety every day. In Pelham, New Hampshire, a crash leaves 81-year-old man dead. Police identify driver killed. Investigation continues. An 81-year-old Hudson, New Hampshire man died following a single vehicle crash on Key Hills Road late Monday afternoon. On Wednesday, the Pelham Police Department identified the man killed, who was driver and sole occupant of the vehicle, as Robert Sharn. Loved ones mourned Sharn's death on social media, writing in one post that the family is grieving the loss of a great man, Robert Sharn. Police also noted on Wednesday afternoon that the circumstances surrounding the crash remain under investigation. The crash involved a gray 2008 Lincoln MKZ occurred near 31 Keys Hill Road at approximately 4:25 p.m. Monday. Emergency crews extricated Sharn from the wreckage and transported him to a local hospital with life-threatening injuries. He was later pronounced deceased. The wreck snapped a utility pole, leaving live wires draped on the car and across the roadway, and led to temporary power outages in surrounding area. The investigation is being conducted by the Pelham Police with assistance from the Hudson, New Hampshire Police Traffic Accident Reconstruction Unit. Keys Hill Road was closed for hours following the crash between Mammoth Road and Castle Hill Road, as well as Kimball Hill Road in Hudson to the Pelham Town Line. Liberty Utilities crews were dispatched to the scene to secure the site and carry out repairs. The Pelham Police urge anyone who may have witnessed the crash to contact Sergeant Ryan Donovan at Pelham Police or call 603-635-2411. Another story from Lowell is $100,000 in Community Connections grants awarded to 10 nonprofits. The Greater Lowell Community Foundation recently announced the recipients of its Community Connections grant program, awarding $10,000 each of 10 nonprofit organizations serving the Greater Lowell community. The $100,000 in total funding will support organizations working to advance equity and strengthen community connections during a critical time for the nonprofit sector. The Community Connection Grant Program builds upon the strong foundation established through GLCF's discretionary grant cycle, recognizing organizations that have proven their commitment to community impact and partnership excellence. Recipients were selected by a community committee and approved by the GLCF board based on their 501c3 status in good standing, demonstrated impact in improving lives in Greater Lowell, and track record of meeting all grant requirements as past grant recipients. At a time when federal funding cuts threaten vital services for our most vulnerable community members, local support has never been more important, says Jennifer Aradia, Vice President of Marketing Programs and Strategy at GLCF. These 10 organizations are on the front lines every day, serving those who need it most. We are honored to provide this flexible funding to support their critical work and strengthen the connections that make our community resilient. The 2025 Community Connection Grant recipients are Boys and Girls Club of Greater Lowell, Cambodian Mutual Assistance Association of Greater Lowell, Coalition for a Better Acre, Latinx Community Center for Empowerment, Merrimack Repertory Theater, Mill City Grows, Project Learn, Center for Hope and Healing, Women's Money Matters, YWCA of Lowell. These organizations represent a diverse spectrum of community needs, from youth development and cultural support to food security, education, healing services, and economic empowerment. Their collective work touches thousands of Greater Lowell residents annually. Among the 10 grant recipients, Project Learn in Lowell received a grant to advance equity and strengthen community connections, We're thrilled with the opportunity to receive this GLCF Community Connections Grant. It will help us increase access to career readiness programming for Lowell students and better enable our team to connect students with local employers for experiential learning, such as paid internships and externships, work-based credentials, mentoring, and career speaker panels. The $10,000 grants provide flexible funding that organizations can use to advance equity and strengthen community connections according to their unique missions and the needs of those they seek. Congratulations to all of them. In the five-minute read, in Lowell Property Assessments, the Lowell Board of Assessors announced that the fiscal 2026 property assessments are now available online. These assessed values reflected estimated fair market value as of January 1st, 2025, and were developed in accordance with the Massachusetts General Laws and Department of Revenue guidelines. Residents and property owners may now review their assessments at lowellmass.gov and then scrolling and finding the correct tab. The Board of Assessors encourages all taxpayers to review their property information for accuracy. Questions may be directed to the assessing department at 978-674-4200 or by visiting the assessor's office at City Hall, 375 Merrimack Street. Hours are Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 8 a.m. to 5. Tuesday from 8 to 8, and Friday 8 to noon. Other departments may have other hours. 38th Annual Christmas Concert. The Chelmsford Community Band rings in the holiday season with adult and children's choirs of First United Baptist Church at Sunday, December 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. The program features new, contemporary, and traditional Christmas songs for all ages. FUBC is located at 99 Church Street. Free parking is available on site. Admission is a free will donation. In honor of FUBC's 200th anniversary celebration, the church is also collecting 200 non-perishable food items for the Lowell Food Pantry. Food and or cash donations can be dropped off any Sunday morning from 11 a.m. to noon, or Monday through Wednesday from 10 a.m. to noon. Monetary donations may be mailed to FUBC, 99 Church Street, Lowell, Mass. 01852. WCAP Radiothon. The Salvation Army of Greater Lowell holds its annual radiothon with WCAP 980 AM on Saturday, December 6th at 61 Market Street. The event includes a live broadcast, an online auction, and opportunities for the community to donate to support local social services throughout the year. Last year's Radiothon helped raise more than $300,000 for the Salvation Army in Lowell. As the cost of living continues to rise, many Massachusetts residents face the growing threat of poverty and the inability to provide for themselves and their families during the holidays. The Salvation Army in Lowell has seen requests for assistance nearly double through their meal program and food pantry. Radiothon funds will help to meet increasing requests for assistance. For more information, call 978-454-4980. Mark your calendars. LYLP Fundraiser. Lowell, the Lowell Youth Leadership Program, hosts its annual celebration and fundraiser on Thursday, December 11th from 6 to 9 at UTEC's Main Hall, 35 Warren Street. LYLP is honoring the relationship it has with Community Teamworks Youth Build Culinary and Carpentry Programs. Food will be provided by Youth Build. Attendees can participate in raffles and auctions, and there will be music by DJ Ricky and a cash bar. All monies raised will fund LYLP's free summer camp for Lowell youth ages 10 through 16. Individual tickets are $65 and sponsorships are also available. Save the date. Christmas pierogies. Lowell, the Holy Trinity Church, 340 High Street, will sell pierogies for Christmas downstairs in the parish hall on Saturday, December 20th from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. Christmas wafers will also be available, as well as stuffed cabbage. Prices range from $6.50 to $28.50. There is a limit of 10 dozen pierogies per order. This is a grab-and-go, first-come, first-serve event. For more information, call the rectory at 978-452-2564 on Mondays, only from 10 to 1. And let's see what we have here. Inside here from the news feed, billionaire spacewalker seeking NASA's top job. Cape Canaveral, billionaire spacewalker Jared Isaacman urged senators on Wednesday to take swift action on his bid to lead NASA after being yanked and then renominated by President Donald Trump. Isaacman appeared before the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee in Washington 8 months after his first nomination hearing. The tech entrepreneur, who's rocketed into space twice with SpaceX, stressed the need for full-time leadership at NASA at the space agency, as the space agency prepares to send astronauts back to the moon early next year. Really? Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has been filling in as NASA's acting administrator since summer. Returning astronauts to the moon for the first time in more than 50 years will be a challenging endeavor, to say the least, Isaacman told the committee led by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. NASA is targeting early next year for a lunar fly-around by 4 astronauts. Doorbell cameras helped capture escapee from an Atlanta hospital. Covington, Georgia, an inmate who touched off a massive search when he escaped from an Atlanta hospital and allegedly stole a car with a handgun inside it, has been captured, authorities announced early Wednesday. Timothy Shane, 52, was apprehended in a residential area of Covington, Georgia, about 35 miles outside of Atlanta, where he had been seen knocking on doors, Rockdale County Sheriff Eric Levitt said in a statement. Officers tracked him down using video surveillance, including images that showed Shane at a grocery store southeast of Atlanta and recordings from home doorbell cameras. A helicopter crew and police dogs joined the search before he was ultimately found inside an empty residence in the neighborhood, the sheriff said. Authorities had warned the public to be wary of Shane, who they said was armed and dangerous. One dead after shooting at MGM National Harbor in D.C. suburbs. One man was killed and another injured in a shooting at a food court at MGM National Harbor Hotel and Casino in the Maryland suburbs of Washington on Wednesday. Detectives were working to determine the circumstances and identify the suspect who fled. Officers responded to a shooting at the food court just before noon, Prince George's County Police said in a social media post. One man died at the resort and a second had an apparent graze wound, police said. Shooting did not appear to be random, police said. Yeah, all those guns. Just what we need, more guns. Today in history, on December 4th, 2025. On this day, in 1783, General George Washington bade farewell to the Continental Army officers at Francis Tavern in New York. In 1918, President Woodrow Wilson left Washington on a trip to France to attend the Versailles Peace Conference. In 1942, during World War II, U.S. bombers struck the Italian mainland for the first time with a raid on Naples. President Franklin Roosevelt ordered the dismantling of the Works Progress Administration, which had been created to provide jobs during the Depression. 1956, Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins gathered for the first and only time for a jam session at Sun Records in Memphis. What a crew that was. 1965, the United States launched Gemini 7 with Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Frank Borman and Navy Commander James Lovell aboard on a two-week mission. In 1978, San Francisco got its first female mayor as city supervisor Dianne Feinstein was named to replace the assassinated George Moscone. In 1980, bodies of four American churchwomen slain in El Salvador 2 days earlier were unearthed. In 1986, both houses of Congress moved to establish special committees to conduct their own investigations into the Iran-Contra affair. Back when Congress did something, huh? In 1992, President George H.W. Bush ordered American troops to lead a mercy mission to Somalia, threatening military action against warlords and gangs who were blocking food for starving millions. In 1995, the first NATO troops landed in the Balkans to begin setting up a peace mission that brought American soldiers into the middle of the Bosnian conflict. And in 2000, in a pair of legal setbacks for Al Gore, a Florida state judge refused to overturn George W. Bush's certified victory in Florida, and the U.S. Supreme Court set aside a ruling that had allowed manual recounts. Okay. Holiday shopping. A look at holiday shopping weekend and what's next. The nation's shoppers may feel gloomy about the economy, but they certainly were in the mood to shop over the 5-day Thanksgiving weekend that wrapped up on Cyber Monday. As Wall Street analysts and retailers sift through the data from the weekend, the unofficial start to the season, and a good barometer of shoppers' financial health and the strength of the economy, figures show that shoppers went online and in stores to scour for deals on everything from TVs to clothing. But all that economic uncertainty did affect spending. Shoppers were very focused and selective, some malls reported. Of course, a weekend looks a lot different from 15 years ago when shoppers camped out in the wee hours of the morning and fought in store aisles for doorbusters like TVs. Shoppers are still heading to stores, but the biggest growth is online, which now accounts for 30% of total holiday sales. That's up from 15% in 2012, according to the National Retail Federation, the nation's largest retail group. Adobe Analytics reported Tuesday that so-called Cyber Week, the 5-day period from Thanksgiving to Cyber Monday, brought in $44.2 billion online overall, up 7.7% year over year, bolstered by record spending online during Black Friday. On Cyber Monday, consumers spent $14.25 billion, up 7%, making again the year's biggest online shopping day. National Retail Federation CEO Matt Shea said Tuesday that shoppers wall off the winter holidays from all the economic noise, building a moat around the season. The holidays is really very much an emotional purchase, Shea said. Families plan for it. They invest in it. And as a component of the holidays, the 5-day Thanksgiving weekend is really the psychological kickoff for the holidays. Based on the group's survey of shoppers from the weekend, Shea called the period a very solid beginning to the holiday season. The group still expects sales over November and December between $1.01 trillion and $1.02 trillion. That would be up 3.7 to 4.2% more than last year. Here's a look at the data, the discounts, and what's next for retailers, among other issues. The latest traffic shows record traffic. Latest data shows record traffic. Software company Salesforce reported that for Cyber Week, it measures from November 25th through Monday, global online sales increased $336.6 billion, up 7% compared with a year ago period. U.S. online sales increased to $79.6 billion, up 5% year for that week compared with a year ago period. The Mall of America in Bloomington, Minnesota reported on Tuesday that more than 235,000 people visited the iconic center on Black Friday, making it the busiest Black Friday on record in the mall's history. The traffic number was up 8.5% compared with the same day on 2024 and nearly 2% above the pre-pandemic 2019, the mall said. MasterCard spending Pulse, which tracks in-person and online spending, reported Saturday that overall Black Friday sales, excluding automotive, rose 4.1% from a year ago. The retail sales indicator, not adjusted for inflation, showed online sales jumped by double digits, 10.4%, while in-store purchases inched up 1.7%. Still, shoppers were laser-focused. William Lewis, marketing director of Westfield Garden State Plaza in Paramus, New Jersey, noted on Black Friday that people are definitely buying. But Lewis noted that shoppers are more targeted and have done their homework ahead of time on social media or school store sites. They know exactly where they're going, he added. Discounts were generous, but don't expect them to get better. Ahead of Thanksgiving weekend, promotions didn't come as early as last year or were more muted, according to some malls and analysts. But for the big weekend, retailers ramped up discounting to be in line with last year's sales event, according to Adobe and big malls like Mall of America. But if shoppers were dilly-dallying about buying a specific sweater and waiting for prices to go down after this weekend, that may not be the best strategy. Discounts won't improve on many items, and stores came into the season with leaner inventory and an uncertain economy, amid an uncertain economy, analysts said. Vivek Pandya, Adobe's director of Adobe Digital Insights, noted that prior to the Thanksgiving weekend kickoff, discounts on average ranged from 10 to 17% and then accelerated to an average range of 18 to 30% for the holiday kickoff. But he expects that retailers will likely pull back from those discounts and will hover a little above what shoppers saw to the run-up of Black Friday. The exceptions would be poor selling seasonal items, which need to be sold before December 25th, Pandya said. As for inventory, there were fears of empty shelves when tariff rates ballooned in April, but analysts said stores were able to navigate the vacillating tariff policy of Taco Trump, bringing in goods at lower rates. Nikki Baird, vice president of strategy at Aptos, a retail technology firm which works with fashion clients, noted, "I think customers will continue to find things that they are looking for, but there will be fewer choices. Some shoppers relied on artificial intelligence tools. Shoppers are using AI tools to track prices or get gift recommendations, though the usage is still modest. On Cyber Monday, AI traffic to U.S. retail sites measured by shoppers increased on a link, increased by near eightfold." Let me read that sentence again. On Cyber Monday, AI traffic to U.S. retail sites measured by shoppers clicking on links increased by nearly eightfold, according to Adobe. From November 1st through December 1st, AI traffic is up nearly ninefold, it said. On the editorial page of the Lowell Sun, we have two local editorials. I'm sorry, one local editorial and a national editorial. The local editorial, "Give Drake it credit for downsizing Murphy's Farm. Just how will the developer of Murphy's Farm Chapter 40B development go?" This is by the Lowell Sun. "That's what residents of East Drake and the rest of the town want to know. We should find out when the Zoning Board of Appeal convenes tonight. The town has already managed to whittle O'Brien Homes of Andover's project from the original 300 apartment units down to 268. But now, as the ZBA has signaled its willingness in a draft decision to sign off on the project, it's pushed the envelope once again by reducing the number of units to 200. First, some historical context on how this eight-year saga has reached its potentially divisive point. In 2017, developer Kevin O'Brien received approval to build single-family housing on about 50 acres on a site off Wheeler Street. The subdivision was never built. Nearly 3 years ago, in February 2023, O'Brien sought and later reviewed site approval from the state to build a 300-unit complex of entirely four-bedroom apartments in 47 buildings on the same 50 acres under the provisions of Chapter 40B. In August 2023, the ZBA proposed a public hearing on whether to give O'Brien a comprehensive permit for the project. Over the intervening months, the developer has provided the site plans, consulting reports, peer reviews, traffic engineering reports, and other engineering documents to support the case for a comprehensive permit. In the draft comprehensive permit, the ZBA has published the number of apartments is down to a mix of 200 one- and two-bedroom units on 33 acres. In support of the decades-old 40B law's objective to increase the state's stock of affordable housing, Murphy's Farms will have 20 low-income units and 20 moderate-income units. Chapter 40B gives the ZBA the sole power to issue comprehensive permits outside of the normal municipal permitting process, though the Conservation Commission does review stormwater runoff concerns. The draft document lists more than 90 conditions the developer must comply with to be granted a comprehensive permit. If approved by the ZBA and accepted by the developer, an agreement would bring an end to the almost 3 years of public hearings, neighborhood meetings, and property tours. But that's a big if. It's apparent O'Brien Homes still found downsizing the development from 300 to 268 units financially palatable, but that might not be the case if it's further reduced by another 68 units. The developer can't appeal the ZBA's decision to the State Housing Appeals Committee, which operates under the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities, if he concludes that the project under these updated conditions no longer makes economic sense. Asked about the prospect of an appeal, developer Kevin O'Brien said, "The town's got to do what it's got to do, and we have to do what we have to do." Anticipating the potential for further litigation, Selectman Tony Arkinski told the newspaper, "I have spoken to the town manager and secured funding for the legal issues. Should the builder appeal the decision? At least the ZBA's updated conditions for approval have earned the support, grudgingly, of the 40B apartment complex's most vocal critic. Speaking for the 1,000 persons strong Citizens Against Reckless Development in Draycott, Michelle Bormeister stated, "We appreciate that the ZBA recognized the project as far too dense and moved to condition the development at 200 units. This reduction helps alleviate some of the anticipated density and traffic impacts on direct abutters and on the broader Draycott community. While we would have preferred an outright denial of the permit, the board's conditions represent meaningful modifications and will leave it to the developer to decide whether to accept the terms or pursue an appeal." She added, "Even so, we remain concerned that the project, despite the reduction, still is overly dense for this area. We also believe the ZBA did not fully address public safety considerations. Extended roadways without cul-de-sacs, leaving no margin for error for emergency response vehicles to maneuver compromising public safety. Other contingencies would further erode the developer's profit margin. Aside from reducing the number of units in the complex, the proposal would make the developer pay $7,500 for sewer connections for each market rate apartment. Connection fees would be waived for affordable units would be waived. In total, the developer would pay $1.125 million for sewer connections. Additionally, connection to the Kenwood Water District would cost $5,500 for the first unit and $4,125 for each additional unit, bringing the estimated total for the 200 units to $826,375. The connection fee for each building must be paid in full prior to connection to the town service. So, how will the protracted tug of war play out? If the developer appeals to that state housing panel, it will entail investing more time and money, further eroding the bottom line of whatever version of the project prevails. Given the resources both the town and developer have expended, maybe it's time for them to find the middle ground that so far has eluded them. Whether it's 268 units, 200 units, or some other number in between, it's an exponentially better outcome than the nightmarish prospect of 300 four-bedroom apartment units first proposed. And from the Los Angeles Times by Stephen Murray, who's an overdose survivor turned paramedic turned public health advocate, and now an adjunct clinical assistant professor at Boston University School of Public Health, he has written about stigma only makes drug use more dangerous, by Stephen Murray. Until we stop framing all drug use and every overdose as problems of addiction and substance use disorders, we'll keep missing the mark on overdose prevention. Historically, overdose was seen as a severe indicator of addiction, but that was never the best way to understand it, given that someone early in their use is potentially at higher risk than someone who uses chronically and has developed a tolerance. The drug supply's unpredictability has further weakened the link between overdose and chronic use, because anyone, a decades-long habitual user or a first-time dabbler, can overdose on drugs that are more potent than expected or that contain substances such as fentanyl. I used opioids, benzodiazepines, and amphetamines for almost 4 years before my family noticed. In that time, I got through 102 credits of college and was elected to the local village council. Most of my drug use was helpful. It made me work harder, helped me cope with depression, and made me a more social, less anxious person. Most persons who use drugs don't see themselves as addicts or meet criteria for a diagnosis of addiction. Most drug use doesn't end in addiction, and many discontinue on their own without treatment. They're not all suffering and waiting to be saved. People use drugs for logical reasons, to ease their pain, to feel happy, to be less anxious, to escape. If they weren't serving a purpose, most people wouldn't start using them. Next time you take a sip of wine or drink a beer, imagine if we considered everyone who drank any amount an alcoholic, or labeled all alcohol consumption alcohol use disorder. The teenager who takes 10 shots in 10 minutes, this was me at 15, will most likely experience an overdose, though this experience alone will be labeled as a bad night, rather than becoming the sole basis of diagnosis for alcohol use disorder. The difference between views of alcohol and drugs reflect our laws, culture, and dominant religious philosophies. In many Islamic countries, alcohol is restricted the same way we treat heroin or cocaine. Parts of South America, the coca plant, where cocaine comes from, is consumed daily much as we drink caffeine. In Mormon communities, caffeine is considered a taboo. If our definitions of acceptable drug use can change so dramatically across borders or religions, then perhaps the real problem isn't the drugs at all, but rather the conditions we have created to consume them. These are real dangers in drug. There are real dangers in drug use, but many of these dangers are not inherent to the drugs themselves. The illicit drug supply is completely unregulated, and it varies widely in potency from one batch to the next. It's as if you drank a cup of coffee one day and it was normal, and the next day it had 200 times the amount of caffeine, but you couldn't tell the difference until it was too late. Legal consumer products such as coffee or prescription drugs are regulated and consistent, regardless of whether experts or prevailing culture considers their use to be healthy. But illegal substances do not benefit from our most basic consumer protection principles. For decades, the dominant approach has been to criminalize drugs and the people who use them. This policy encourages people to use alone. Hiding drug use is deadly. In California, more than 80% of overdose fatalities that occurred in a private location happened in the decedent's home. The people who die from overdoses are often housed, employed, parents, caregivers, neighbors, and friends. They're dying quietly in bedrooms and bathrooms because shame and fear make isolation feel safer than disclosing use, even the people who love them most. Half of all deaths occurred with a bystander nearby who did not respond to the overdose, either because they were separated, like being in a different room, 45% of the time, or because they were unaware the decedent was using drugs, 30%. The risk of disclosure during active use can be catastrophic. People lose jobs, custody, housing, partners, and their freedom. Courts and child welfare systems treat all drug use as criminal behavior that isn't compatible with parenting. Even within treatment systems, a return to use is often punished and not met with compassion. Drug criminalization doesn't stop people from using drugs, but it pushes use underground and makes it more dangerous. According to a recent report by California Correctional Health Care Services, not only is overdose the leading cause of death for people who are incarcerated, it is also the leading cause of death for people leaving incarceration in California. As an alternative to incarceration, there is a growing movement for involuntary commitment where people are forced into lock treatment facilities. When we take away someone's autonomy under the guise of save them, we replicate the same moral logic that drives punishment, that people who use drugs can't be trusted with their own lives. In Massachusetts, where we have had involuntary commitment for decades, research has shown that during the first 3 days after release, there are 41% increased risk of death from overdose compared with people who sought care on their own. Overdose prevention has been treated as synonymous with addiction treatment, as if the only way to save lives is to get people into recovery. But what if prevention also means creating conditions where people can be safe even if they're still using? What if it means acknowledging that drugs can have positive effects for people and that the real danger comes from an unregulated supply, stigma, and isolation? The next phase of overdose prevention must move beyond punishment and the fantasy that everyone who uses drugs is broken and waiting to be fixed. We can build something better. We can create systems and narratives rooted in dignity, safety, and compassion for everyone, whether they use drugs, stop using, or use again. That starts with how we talk to people we love. Instead of reacting with fear or judgment, start with curiosity by asking, what does it do for you? How does it help? What would make it feel safer? If someone in your life uses drugs, you don't need to approve or condone it to care about their safety. You can keep naloxone nearby and learn how to use it in case of opioid overdose. You can check in without lecturing. You can talk openly about using in safer ways, like not using alone, testing your supply when you can, in starting slow with anything new. And if they trust you enough to use in your presence, reject the narrative that says your role is enabling. You are choosing love. You are choosing connection over concealment. Every overdose we prevent begins with one person deciding to stay and to not turn away. That small but radical act of compassion can save a life. It can start with you. From the sports page of the Lowell Sun. The Rams are one win from defending the title. Shaheen, 12-0, will battle Foxborough for Division 5 crown. Cool. The Shaheen Tech and Foxborough High School teams will renew a rivalry on Friday that has had two significant chapters in recent years. It really has turned into quite a rivalry, said Ram coach Al Costa. Costabile. We lost them in the Final Four and then played them last year in the Super Bowl. This will be the third straight time that we've had them twice at Gillette Stadium. Last year, the Rams won the Super Division 5 Super Bowl with a 14-0 win at Gillette. In 2023, Foxborough topped Shaheen in the semifinals to the tune of 42-12 on the way to the Division 5 Super Bowl. After beating Shaheen, Foxborough chalked up a 48-21 win over Hanover in the state championship. In 2022, Foxborough was actually a Division 4 team and beat both Pembroke and Bedford in the playoffs before a 21-12 Final Four loss in Grafton. Grafton eventually lost the Division 4 Super Bowl that year. Shaheen made the Division 5 Super Bowl in 2022, falling to the North Reading 44-28. The top-seeded Rams, 12-0 overall, exercised those demons 2 weeks ago at Danvers High with a dramatic 22-14 overtime win over North Reading in Division 5 semifinals, earning round 3 against the second-seeded Warriors on Friday back at Gillette at 5 p.m. Shaheen has won 26 straight games. While Shaheen's 2024 championship team was guided by the passing of quarterback Sid Tidsley and a punishing defense, this season the ground game has been front and center for the Rams, led by senior Jake Banda. I'm so proud of the players, and I'm so proud of their work ethic, Costabile said. This is the strongest team I've had at Shaheen, and that is directly related to the time they put in. And I am so proud of my coaches. I have very, very hard-working coaches. I'm a very lucky guy. Senior quarterback Adam Caruso, in his first season as a starter as a replacement for Tidsley, has successfully guided the offense with plenty of weapons at his disposal, including senior wideout Dylan Pratt, sophomore Nathan Smith, and junior Quinn Carboni. What Adam lacked was experience, said Costabile of Caruso. That's no knock on him. He's just happened to be coming from long after Sid Tidsley. And top of it all, he lost 3/4 of a junior varsity season with a broken finger. But Caruso improved throughout the season. He needed experience, Costabile said. I think what you've seen this year is with experience, he has shown steady improvement throughout this year. I'm very happy with the job he's doing. The running game features Banda, his younger brother Cam Banda, a sophomore and senior James Tidsley. Shaheen's linemen have been dominant, led by senior Nathan Mallendale and senior Eric Banda, while the linebacking tandem of Tilsley was led Shaheen in tackles for 4 straight years, and Jake Banda could be one of the best 1-2 punches in the state. Ralph Raymond and Cole Pellegrino joined Pratt, Smith, and Carboni as forces in the secondary. Costa Biles said the Rams are healthy as the state finals approach. We're pretty healthy, the coach said. To be healthy as we are at this point of the season, after all the games, we feel fortunate. The playoffs started for Shaw Sheen with a 55-14 thumping of Salem before a 28-17 win against St. Mary's of Lynn. In the semis finals, Shaw Sheen rallied from an early deficit to beat the Hornets in an overtime classic. Foxborough 9-3, meanwhile, hasn't been tested in the postseason with a 41-13 shellacking Norton, 28-0 blanking of Gloucester, and a 31-0 triumph over Archbishop Williams. The Warriors have outscored their three postseason opponents by a 100-13 margin. They're a really solid team, and they're out of a really good league, Costa Biles said. They're an opponent to be taken very seriously. In a win against the Archies, junior running back Jack Taft scored three touchdowns for Foxborough and totaled 78 yards rushing and 25 yards receiving. Senior quarterback Cam Dulesky had another touchdown for the Warriors, and junior kicker Andrew Higgins added a 30-yard field goal. The Warriors have 20 seniors on their roster, including six captains, a group composed of Dulesky, running back Ryan Foley, running back Gabe Buell, receiver Colby Hassett, tight end Trevor Palmer, and standout lineman Matthew O'Keefe. The captains are really what make the team go, said Costa Biles. They're leaders and they're a well-balanced team. Foley is the team's top back but has been injured late in the season. Foley's status for Friday's game is unknown. He's been hurt the last 3 or 4 weeks, Costa Biles said. We'll see as far as how much he plays and where he plays. I expect he'll play. Taft and Buell are other top weapons out of Foxborough's backfield. Last year's title game between Shaw Sheen and Foxborough was a thriller and defensive battle. The game was scoreless until 7:15 was left in the fourth quarter. Sid Tidsley rushed for a 1-yard touchdown, and senior Jack Finn added the extra point to go up 7-0. The Ram defense then stepped up. A pass rush from Malandane led to Jack Banda's interception with 2:42 remaining. Banda nearly scored on the play before Tilsley powered his way into the end zone on a first and goal with a 2-yard touchdown. Finn's extra point put the Rams up 14-0 with 2:37 remaining. Costa Biles knows it will take another near-perfect game to win on Friday. We're going to need everybody, he said. We're going to need our best effort. Anything short of that won't get the job done. Good luck to them. And from Tewksbury, Burns' major catch for undefeated Tewksbury. Senior tight end, defensive end, excited to play in Division IV. Super Bowl on Sunday. In his 29th year as a head football coach at Tewksbury High School, Brian Iward coached his share of great tight ends. Ask about number 86, Jake Burns, and the coach doesn't mince words. He's as talented as there is in the area. He's one of the most complete tight ends that we've had since I've been here, said Iward, who began coaching in 1997. I've had a lot of great tight ends here, but a lot of them weren't profile tight ends, more like running backs or converted receivers. A lot of schools will have a big kid who will run around and catch a couple passes, but they don't block as well. And then there's other teams who have guys at that position who can block really well, but don't really catch the ball that well. Burnsy does it all. A 3-year starter, 2-year starter as a defensive end, Burns is a complete package when it comes to playing tight end. He's a phenomenal blocker and is passionate about the job. He can catch his share of touchdown passes. On the season, he had 19 receptions for 234 yards with 7 touchdowns. In the state semifinal win against Duxbury 2 weeks ago, Burns had 4 catches for 62 yards and a pair of touchdowns. He averages a touchdown every 2.7 catches and averages 12.3 yards per carry. Burns will certainly be a viable option again for sophomore quarterback Will Harrison for the Redmen when the Redmen take on Scituate for the Division IV state title on Saturday at Gillette Stadium, 12:45. Thing that sets him apart is his hands are exceptional, said Eilward. I think he's got to be up there on the all-hands team since I've been coaching here. In the years that he's been here, I don't think I've seen a ball hit his body. He catches everything extended with his hand. He adjusts the ball as if he's a big guy. He's a college-ready tight end for sure. Burns has visited schools like New Hampshire and Bentley, but no formal offers have been made. Eilward believes a 6'2", 250-pound senior captain with a 4.1 GPA can make the leap and play at an elite level in college. Until then, Burns will start by playing in the biggest game of his life on Saturday. I'm not surprised that we're going to the Super Bowl, but I am just super excited and just so happy that we're all having this opportunity, said Burns, who is also a standout defender on the lacrosse team. Everyone on the team is so excited, and I can't wait for Saturday to come. To be able to just play there is going to be awesome. We know that Scituate is going to be the toughest team that we'll face this season. They have a bunch of good players, but we're confident going into the game 100%. Burns started playing football when he was in the second grade. He started out as an offensive linebacker before being switched to running back. In the fifth grade, his coaches moved him to tight end, and he hasn't relinquished the post since. Being a tight end, we didn't throw the ball that much at the youth level, so I was mostly blocking. I continued that through high school, but I do like to get the ball too, he said. When we run our exchange motion, I get a good number of blocks. I just try to pick up their defensive end and try to open a gap. That has happened a lot and with great success. Tewksbury has rushed for 193 yards per game and is averaging 334 total yards of offense. Burns' elite blocking has a lot to do with those numbers. Jake's such an easygoing guy. He enjoys football a lot. He enjoys being around the guys a lot. He's a good leader and he's friendly with everybody. He's a gamer on the field. He grinds for us, says Eilward. If we need to ramp up the physicality on one side of the ball or the other, he's usually the guy who spears that. We ask him to do a lot of different things. If we are going to be as multiple as we have been this season with all the shifts and motions as we do, the tight end must be smart, kid, and understand when we're moving him and why we're moving him. And he's got great savvy that way. He's just been an awesome player for us. An awesome player with an awesome opportunity in his final high school game. I'm just so grateful to have this opportunity, and hopefully we can go there and get a win while playing on Gillette's turf. It's crazy to think how many great players have walked on that turf, Burns said. Add Tewksbury's number 86 to that list. And more local sports. Sullivan named MVC Division II Player of the Year from Tewksbury. Tewksbury High School seniors football star Johnny Sullivan has been named the Merrimack Valley's Conference Division II Player of the Year. Sharing Offensive Player of the Year honors in Division II were Tewksbury senior Ben Christopher and Lowell senior Ryan Conley. Lowell senior Stephen Manny was selected as a Division II Defensive Player of the Year. Sharing Coach of the Year honors in Division II were Brian Eilward of Tewksbury and Scott Boyle of Lowell. This was an extremely impressive fall for local MVC teams. Tewksbury is undefeated and will play Scituate for the Division IV state title on Saturday in Gillette Stadium in Foxborough. Lowell ripped off a long-running streak and advanced to the state tournament where it advanced with a victory over Methuen. Sullivan was one of 12 Redmen honored by the MVC. Lowell has 11 players recognized. Chelmsford 7, Billerica 4, Drake 2. Total of 16 local standouts were chosen for the first team all-conference performers, including junior Jackson Guerin, junior Prince Mahe of Billerica, senior Chris Desrochers, senior Nate Dugan, senior Jake Myers of Chelmsford, junior Daniel Jakes of Drake, junior Joshua Emanqua, junior Colin Christensen, senior Joseph Flores, senior Seth Lai, and seniors Ricky Thom of Lowell, and senior Jake Burns, senior Nikki DeSisto, sophomore Will Harrison, senior Victor Muyanja, and senior Amik Olu of Tewksbury. In pro soccer, the North Carolina Courage of the National Women's Soccer Team Soccer League provide an update on the team's roster status headed into the 2025 season. 19 current players are under contract through at least 2026. Among the players with an expiring contract at the end of the calendar year is Wilmington native Olivia Wingate. Wingate missed this past season with an injury. The former Wilmington High standout was drafted with the sixth pick, 2023 NWSL college draft after a four-year standout career at Notre Dame. At Notre Dame, she's made 74 starts and saw action in 95 games. She recorded 26 goals and dished out 11 assists. Wingate broke out as a senior with 14 goals, earning All-ACC first team and All-America third team, All-American third team honors. Nine members of the Emerson College women's soccer program have been recognized for their efforts in the classroom and the spot on the New England Women's and Men's Athletic Conference academic all-conference team. Junior Kaylin O'Mara of Littleton earned the honor for the second straight year. College basketball, the UMass women's basketball team was held to 9 points in the fourth quarter during a 67-56 non-league loss to Iona. UML trailed 31-26 at halftime before going up 41-39 with 5:10 left in the third quarter. The Riverhawks shot the ball well in the quarter, pocketing 21 points, but Iona played strong defense down the stretch. Janie Edmonds led the Riverhawks 3-5 with 16 points. Clementia Modena contributed 13 points, and Tiana Medina also reached double figures with 11 points. Sabrina Larson hauled down 8 rebounds. UMass Lowell was coming off a dominant 82-36 victory over Maine Fort Kent in Lowell. And I think that's it for local sports. Oh, we have in Fitchburg, Fitchburg Art Museum reopens and has plans for its centennial. After closure for a couple months, Fitchburg Art Museum reopened yesterday and is ready for visitors to come and celebrate its centennial. On view now through next May 24th is Tara Celios, Ask Now the Beast. Celios is a Boston-based artist whose monumental photographs highlight the beauty of the grotesque. She creates still life vignettes from organic materials, including animal bones, insect specimens, and dried flowers, which she photographs using a large format 8x10 camera. Printed at large scale, Celios' photographs capture the vivid details of her material. Her imagery takes inspiration from Christian devotionals, including illuminated manuscripts, altarpieces, and stained glass windows, while engaging with historical traditions of still life painting, including Dutch vanitas paintings. Celios' series, Ask Now the Beast, derives its title from the Book of Job, exploring the concepts of harvest and apocalypse. In this new work, Celios considers the cyclical nature of the earth, intertwining symbols of death and references to life with beauty of decay. And musically, holiday pop is the annual tradition in Western Lowell. Thanksgiving is over and Christmas is here in 3 weeks. So much to do, so little time. But that doesn't mean we forget the time-honored traditions that we love to do each year. And for your stage's scribe, it means the annual holiday chat with Maestro Keith Lockhart sharing seasonal greetings and news of the holiday pops runouts to Worcester's Hanover Theater on Friday, December 5th and Lowell's Memorial Auditorium on Sunday, December 14th. We have audience member at our Symphony Hall holiday concert from Worcester and Lowell, but we love the runouts. There is a definitely family feel to those concerts, and that's why we keep coming back, Lockhart said Tuesday morning. Capturing the magic of the Christmas season and the winter charms of New England, the Boston Pops Esplanade Orchestra will perform holiday classics, the traditional pop sing-along of carols, and new arrangements of seasonal favorites, including A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. It's the ultimate story of a miser's redemption and my favorite Christmas story after that of the original First Christmas, says Lockhart. They are joined by the Metropolitan Chorale, known as one of the Metro Boston's premier choral ensembles. Santa Claus himself will make a guest appearance during the guest concert's finale. All are invited to celebrate the most wonderful time of the year with family, friends, and merry music, with the holiday pops this December. Performing festival favorites from the cultural traditions around the world, the Pops and Lockhart promises to get you in the holiday spirit quicker than you can sing fa-la-la-la. In the Wings Holiday Fair, there are plenty of other holiday offerings to choose from in this coming weeks to celebrate the most wonderful time of the year. Not interested in battling traffic, but still love the music of the season. The Chelmsford Community Band has three upcoming concerts starting tomorrow, December 5th, when the Jazz Ensemble plays Holiday Pops at 7 p.m. at Chelmsford Center for the Arts. On Sunday, December 7th, a concert at First United Baptist Church, 99 Church Street in Lowell. And on Sunday, December 14th, at 2 p.m., it's another holiday concert at McCarthy Middle School, 250 North Road, Chelmsford. A Christmas Carol at NSMT. The holiday season will light up once again when Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater in Beverly presents the area's most beloved production of A Christmas Carol for its 36th annual production from Thursday, December 4th through Sunday, December 21st. More next week, but tickets start at $40. Bad Bunny has dethroned Taylor Swift as the most streamed artist. Holiday season is here, and with it a present for fans of end-of-the-year data and marketing. Spotify Wrapped is here, and Puerto Rican superstar Bad Bunny has been named for its most played artist for a fourth time, dethroning Taylor Swift. On Wednesday, the streaming giant unveiled its annual overview of individual listening trends, as well as trends from around the world. Users can now access our top artists, songs, genres, albums, and podcasts, as well as uncover which artists had the biggest year on the platform. Here's what you need to know. Chart-topping performers continue to dominate. The reggaeton and then some artists was 2025's most streamed artist globally, having earned more than 19.8 billion streams. He is followed by Swift, The Weeknd, Drake, and Billie Eilish, in that order. For the past 2 years, Swift has commanded the top spot globally, claiming it in 2023 and holding it for 2024, having dethroned Bad Bunny. He held the coveted title for 3 years in a row, beginning in 2020. Now he's back on top. In the U.S., the most streamed artist list looks somewhat similar. There, Swift leads, followed by Drake, Morgan Wallen, Kendrick Lamar. Bad Bunny is in fifth. The most streamed album globally was, of course, Bad Bunny's Ooh, Debbie Tirar Moss Photos, followed by K-Pop Demon Hunters. Soundtrack and three releases from 2024, Billie Eilish's Hit Me Hard and Soft, SCA's SOS Deluxe, and Sabrina Carpenter's Short and Sweet, in that order. In the U.S., it differs slightly. The most streamed album is Wallen's I'm the Problem, followed by SCA, Bad Bunny, K-Pop Demon Hunters soundtrack, and Lamar's GNX. Globally, the most streamed song title goes to Bruno Mars and Lady Gaga's collaboration, Die With a Smile, which has racked over 1.7 billion streams. Then it's Eilish's Birds of a Feather, Mars's and Rose's APT, Alex Warren's Ordinary, and Bad Bunny's DTMF. Lamar and SCA's Luther was the most streamed song in the U.S., followed by Die With a Smile, Ordinary, Birds of a Feather, and in fifth, Lamar and Lefty's Gunplay's TV Off. What's new with Spotify Wrapped this year? Like every year, there are a few new features. These include the introduction of top albums, a fan leaderboard to show users where they stack up in artist streams, a listening age feature that compares a user's streaming habits to those in their age range, and much more. There is also something called Wrapped Party, an interactive feature which allows users to compare their Wrapped with other Spotify users. These additions differ from last year, when some Spotify users complained of social media that Wrapped, which undergoes design changes every year, was minimalist in 2024. They said it lacked features, previous features like top cities, audio auras, and top genres. The latter has been reinstated for 2025. I have to confess, I don't know any of those artists or those computer apps. Guess I'm getting old. That's it from the Lowell Sun. We have a few minutes to look at the Eagle Tribune. And we will read from the opinion page of the Eagle Tribune. The Lady Spectre by Joe DeMore, The Outward View. She loomed through the smoky water, inaudible with illuminating sun rays that appear to push her along. At sunrise, stillness takes longer than light to produce conditions which vitalize the senses. Surely she could not be under her own power, as there was no self-propulsion evident, as would be expected if the belching of a diesel engine was heard. The water graciously carried her. She was a specter, a ghost ship, first emerging from my mind and then spilling onto the swirling, blackened waters of Cape Cod Canal. At her presentation, the water conspired to cause a haze in the beholder's eyes. Apparently, the canal was in the grips of a protest from being transformed from a meandering river of warmth from summer temperatures to the inevitable transformation of unwelcoming cold, watery tendrils. Apparently, the sun's stinging cool air of autumn made an unwelcome assault, causing an inevitable struggle that produced the commotion of fog. Seawater is funny that way. When bathed by sustained energy from the sun and warm currents arriving from seas closer to the equator, it becomes lively, colorful, and capable of granting buoyancy with less effort. But when iced, water becomes broody and uninviting to the point of rudeness. Water has two personalities, it seems, or at least that's my perception after 50 years of walking every asphalted and pebbled course on either side of the Cape Cod Canal and the slivers of rocky beaches that emanate in opposite directions. One stretches north toward the Sagamore Bluffs and the other south with distant views of Oyster Bed Flats and Dennis. She was a scalloper traversing the entrance of the canal from southern shores, intent on engaging the open sea. Her name, Lady D, belies the gritty work ahead. Resilient and capable of keeping her crew safe, she was about to set sail on an adventure with a commercial purpose but an intrepid engagement. Anytime we are bound out to sea, there is danger. The name is inappropriately stately for a working girl. Scallopers are not luxury yachts. They ravage the bottoms of oceans with their steel-toothed dredging devices, devouring scallops, lobsters, rock crabs, and occasionally discarded fishing gears, shopping carts, and tire rims. The hardy bunch clinging to these vessels with a propensity for adventure may hold a grudge against their station in life or alternately be as liberated as swashbuckling pirates in a command of their destiny. They weigh the possibility of not returning from an angry sea if weather transforms from something other than accurately forecast. Weather off New England waters has a storied reputation for being uncooperative with boat captains. For the crew, first mates, and captains, the thrill can be in balancing a desire for commercial gain while accepting risks of financial loss, or worse yet, the unintended onset of death. The work is brisk, with limbs always in danger of being included in the catch of scallops. But when successful, in their ice holds is treasure. The ocean is the elixir of gods that proliferates, life forms that sustain us. The mix originated before our evolutionary ancestors shed fins for feet, took tentative steps on dry land, and then sought to return to where they came from to take sustenance. I will walk the beaches and the stretches of the canal, frequently hoping to see her safely return. It will be exhilarating for me to view the crewmen with smiles, sporting deeply etched furrows and creases on their faces that are a bit smoother after enduring travails on the open sea. I will be as relieved as they surely will be. And from the Virginian Pilot, guard shooting underlines folly of domestic deployment. Last week's shooting of 20-year-old Army National Guard Specialist Sarah Beckstrom and U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf was a devastating tragedy. These two young service members pledged their lives to defend the Constitution only to be targeted in a cowardly attack in the nation's capital. With the shooter in custody, Americans can have faith that the criminal justice system will mete out punishment for this dastardly act of violence. But the public should also speak up in forceful opposition to the continued deployment of military forces to cities such as Washington, D.C., which are unjustified and whose legality remains in question before the courts. Hear, hear. A day before millions of Americans gathered with family and friends to celebrate Thanksgiving, Beckstrom, who died, and Wolf, who remains in critical condition, were among those troops still patrolling the District of Columbia under orders from President Donald Trump. President deployed 800 National Guard troops to Washington in August, claiming that the city was overrun by crime and the presence of military forces was necessary to quell a falsely proclaimed public safety emergency. In fact, violent crime in D.C. has reached a 30-year low in 2024, according to data confirmed by the U.S. Department of Justice in January. More to the point, though a spike in criminal activity, if it existed, would be better addressed through more law enforcement personnel, additional resources for intervention and deterrence programs, and assisting local prosecutors, all workable solutions that most cities would embrace when faced with a surge in violence. Instead, Trump turned to the National Guard deployment, introduced hundreds of uniformed personnel without law enforcement experience into an untenable situation. Many of those sent to Washington spent their days standing in metro stations, taking photos with tourists, and cleaning up trash rather than assisting in law enforcement. The late Beckstrom is but one example, her story emblematic of an assignment rife with problems. She sought a career in criminal justice and believed enlistment in the National Guard would help her achieve that goal. A former boyfriend interviewed after last week's tragedy said Beckstrom cried about being deployed to D.C. from her small town of Somersville, but over time found solace in visiting museums and learning the city's history. On November 26, Beckstrom and Wolf were standing near the entrance of the Farragut West Metro Station in downtown Washington when authorities allege Ramanullah Lekanawal, a 29-year-old Afghan man, shot them. Wolf remains in critical condition and a grieving nation hopes for his recovery. Luckenwall came to this country with his wife and children following the messy and deadly withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021. He'd worked with American forces during the 20-year war there and reportedly assisted a unit in Kandahar overseen by the USA. Trump administration blamed the violence on former President Joe Biden, though Trump negotiated the Afghanistan withdrawal during his first term, and Luckenwall was granted asylum in April during Trump's second term. In response to the shooting, the administration ordered a halt to asylum decisions for Afghan nationals. State Department also froze a special immigrant visa program for those who assisted U.S. forces in Afghanistan, leaving that population in limbo and further gumming up the path to safety for the thousands of our allies. The president also ordered an additional 500 National Guard troops to Washington, adding to the roughly 2,000 already there. That may be short-lived, however. On November 20th, a federal judge concluded the deployment was likely illegal, but withheld a formal decision for 3 weeks to allow the administration to appeal. Even as the nation mourns the loss of one promising young life and the irreparable harm inflicted to another, the public should hope that the case is resolved in a way that honors the Constitution and removes American troops from this American cities. We are eternally grateful for their service, but certain that Beckstrom and Wolf and all their colleagues should have been home for Thanksgiving. It is a terrible and avoidable tragedy that they were not. And to the editor, Charles Wegrens from West Newbury. Another shooting, another failure. Once again, we have a shooting of innocent people, this time two National Guard members from West Virginia. Seems that we never get a rest from the killing of our children and other Americans. Will we ever get past our love of guns and death? With the murder of Sarah Beckstrom, there's enough blame to go around for her death. First is President Donald Trump, his grandstanding and myopic need to punish Americans. Next are Republicans in Congress who seem to have neglected oversight of the administration. Let's not forget the shooter himself. How many times do we have to hear about the mental state of a shooter before we do something about it? The National Guard is supposed to be the backstop for our military, occasionally called to duty in times of emergency. Police are trained to handle cases like the shooter. If there were so much crime in D.C., Trump should have led Congress to increase the budget of D.C., allowing it to hire more police. This is what a true leader does, and someone who believes in the Constitution and the rule of law. Instead, we have a president who doesn't spend much time thinking, anytime, and leading this nation of the willing. And a letter by Sandra Brown of Merrimack to the editor. It's the getting here that baffles. Pete Hegseth, possible war criminal. Kash Patel flies his girlfriend at cost to the taxpayers. Christy Noem flying immigrants to El Salvador against judge's order, and then outrageously posing in front of those men. White House spokesperson Karen Leavitt, the perfect sycophant for her boss, lies and more lies, and so proud of her misinformation. Robert Kennedy Jr., a vile person unloading serious misinformation about vaccines that even his former family warned us. Thank you, Senate, for approving him. Pam Bondi, a true horror show, so-called people's lawyer, but is not. Same for the less than Supreme Court. On top of these monsters, the EPA has reduced restrictions on our waterway. U.S. aid has been stopped, essentially killing a number of children in third world countries. Snap, stop for a period of time. So hurtful to many people. Tariffs come and go, all due to Trump's whim. The black shirts reign supreme with their ICE badges. Once again, another lie that just the most dangerous will be deported. A young Babson student handcuffed and shackled and sent to Honduras over Thanksgiving. What have we become? The insurrectionists pardoned by the president. When he says horrible things about any person that either asks him a question he doesn't want to answer or defames people who oppose him, or as lunatics make death threats and bomb threats, you have to wonder if that's why he pardoned those insurrectionists sent to the Capitol, most presumably by him. It's past time that Congress woke up and accepted the fear and loathing from the president and stopped this horror show. He must be impeached. With great luck, the House will become Democratic in 2026, and this reign of terror should end. vote. Hear, hear, Miss Brown. And we have time for a Dear Abby letter to end with. Argumentative abusive brother alienates family. Dear Abby, I have a brother who's very opinionated and in my face anytime I don't agree with him. It doesn't matter what the subject is. He thinks he's the only one who knows anything about it. He's not educated, but he thinks he's smarter than everybody else, even the educated people. He won't let me get a word in while he's yelling and screaming in my face. He resorts to name-calling, telling me I'm wrong and calling me stupid. Later, he sends emails and texts trying to prove to me why I'm wrong. I think he's abusive and has a mental disorder. He's accomplished nothing in his life. My husband and I have careers. If I try to remain quiet around my brother, he starts aggravating me to get a reaction. He has alienated my family. No one wants to be around him. What's the best way to shut him down to make whatever time we have to spend together more civil? Dear sis, no magic formula will shut down your abusive, immature, and possibly mentally ill brother. Accept the fact you can't change him and save your sanity by avoiding him as often as possible. And that appears to be it. Thank you. You have been listening to Lowell Association of the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUMLFM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. There are several ways you may listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver for more information, or for more information about a radio reading service, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Barry. Thank you for listening. We will try to do better again next week. Hope you do well in the meantime.